Hey, DC, did you know that it's Arbor Week? And that means it's the perfect time to learn about and protect our trees. Local nonprofit Casey Trees is helping to protect our tree canopy by teaching kids the value of trees and working with them to plant new ones. The trees they're planting now ensure that future Washingtonians have a beautiful and healthy city. So support Casey Trees today by giving online at caseytrees.org/give. Your tax-deductible donation will go directly toward tree planting efforts in historically underserved communities, including schools in Wards 5, 7, and 8. Once again, that's caseytrees.org/give. Let's plant some trees, y'all.
Here's what DC is talking about. The biggest local news story in a long time, which is the congressional vote to overturn a DC bill for the first time in decades. CityCast DC producer Julia Caron and newsletter editor Kayla Cote Stemmerman are here to break down what it means and what happens now. Plus, we're talking about the weird trend of dress codes for DC bars, and Kayla is going to tap her newsletter knowledge to tell us about the best of weekend events. Today is Friday, March 10th. I'm Michael Schaefer, and this is CityCast DC. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Mike. How you doing, man?
I'm all right. Hey, Kayla.
Good morning.
So the horrible tragedy of the DC criminal code rewrite ended Wednesday night in kind of resounding fashion with a surprisingly lopsided vote in the Senate, 81-14.
Sheesh.
To overturn the bill. That's a veto-proof majority. Not that it matters because the president has said he will sign the bill. Under DC's home rule, we have self-government, but any bill that passes the DC council within a certain number of days, I think it's 60 days, Congress can vote to disapprove of the bill and it gets rejected. This hasn't happened in 30 years.
So literally as long as I've been alive.
Correct.
Damn.
Correct. I think those two things are related.
Blame it on me. It's fine. Just blame it on me.
So look, this is a thing. There's been a lot of anger. There were protests at Union Station. There's an effort to tie in home rule and statehood in Washington to racial justice, which is a long part of its history, but has been less emphasized by people in that movement in recent years. But there's a lot of anger on the part of people who supported this criminal code rewrite, as well as on the part of people who opposed it. The mayor had vetoed it. She got overridden. She lost. But, in her view, and in a lot of people's view, it was a thing that was duly passed. This is a democracy. And people who don't answer to the voters here don't get to overrule those voters, don't get to legislate for us. And they shouldn't be doing this. That was the mayor's position. There's, I think, also going to be some recriminations there, on the local level. You know, we have a very progressive DC council. I expect it's more progressive than the mean citizen of Washington. Bowser herself, who is comparatively a moderate, got overwhelmingly reelected. I think it's totally plausible that this criminal code rewrite, which rewrites like a 100-year-old criminal code that was like everybody, prosecutors and defenders and everyone else, said was in need of a rewrite just to rationalize it and bring it up to date. I could believe that a majority of our citizens would favor it. I suspect it's nothing like the unanimous majority in the council. But that's kind of neither here nor there on a principles matter because it passed and it should get to stay.
So I think part of this is a timing issue more than anything. We tried to get this criminal code through at a time when people feel that crime is on the rise in the city, particularly carjackings. Like, this doesn't just magically make it okay to like carjack and burgle and rob. It, you know, makes the maximum penalties lower, and it replaces the sentencing range with a new tiered system. It just makes the penalties less draconian and brings them up to date now. And also, like, President Biden, a Democrat, who has said he's in favor of home rule. He tweeted about it. He's like, I'm in favor of home rule, but I just can't pass this. He has to run for re-election again in 2024, which, like, I know we don't want to think about, but that's a year away. And being the, like, soft-on-crime president, I think, is not the move right now. So I think this is kind of a political posturing for the rest of the country saying, I am tough on crime. look at what I'm doing in this particular instance.
Right. It's also ironic because even though some of the penalties were lowered, they were still much harsher than a lot of the states whose representatives voted against this bill.
Right.
Right. And I think that if you start thinking of these arguments in like logical terms, you know, it all goes haywire.
It doesn't make
right?
any
like,
sense. Yeah.
It's very slippery slope.
We're being lectured about public safety by representatives of some of the most violent, murder-ridden states in the country. We're being lectured about poverty by some of the representatives of states with the you know highest poverty and inequality in the country. Like on that level, it's kind of crazy. But this is the reality we're in. This is the country we have. This is the constitution we have. This is the home rule legal framework that exists. And I found myself just kind of amazed at how sort of detached from like the national conversation a lot of the activists in local politics were. And this is like not an atypical thing. We're in such close proximity to national power in Washington, but the local and national exist in these different worlds and often like see each other in kind of a kabuki theater sort of exaggerated, caricatured way. So are you thinking there's a media failure there in terms of conveying what's in this thing?
In terms of saying like, here is what this bill actually says. Yes, like, why didn't someone, like, and I don't watch the Sunday shows. I am guilty of this. I'm not a fan of TV news. But, like, why isn't someone on the council, like, going on a Sunday talk show and talking to a reporter and saying, here is what is actually in this thing. And, oh, by the way, again, we're not saying all of these things are legal. We're just getting them up to date because our criminal code is literally a century old.
I think in a moment when people are scared.
Yes.
That kind of nuance is really hard. Even the most articulate and brilliant communicator, and the DC Council does not seem to have a lot of those, would have a hard time making that point in a moment when people are petrified and perhaps thinking irrationally.
You know, posted this on our Instagram and people were not fans of the bill. I mean, you know, they're saying like they shouldn't have forwarded such a deftone bill. They should have compromised, you know, with the mayor. They shouldn't have pressed such a progressive bill. It's really sad to see Washingtonians happy about Congress overruling us, but it's not unreasonable.
I mean, I think that's kind of the colonial mentality, right? That like people say they want statehood, but are actually like if they can work the system so that they get what they want through other means, like having Congress do it, that works for some people. But look, there is another like red meat for right-wing media bill that has passed the DC Council and is going to face a disapproval vote on the Hill. And I have a hard time imagining the disapproval vote will not succeed.
Yeah. So actually, we're starting a new local civics section in our newsletter. And this was the perfect opportunity to talk about what's going to be happening next. This new bill, DC's Local Resident Voting Rights Amendment Act, passed through DC Council at a similar time, and the bill would allow non-citizen residents to vote in local elections so long as they're over 18 and they have lived here for more than 30 days. So the House was not eager to play along. In the end, 42 Democrats, they all voted to block the bill. So now it's in the hands of the Senate, but the Senate only has 30 days to block it, which means that they would have to vote on the bill before March 14th if they want to reject it. So pretty soon. But if it is adopted, DC would be the biggest jurisdiction in the country to have, you know, a non-citizens voting bill, which would be pretty cool. What do you guys think is going to happen?
Tom Cotton, the conservative Republican from Arkansas, was fundraising against this as of a couple weeks ago. And I am baffled as to why they would do this. It is kind of right at the nexus of like immigration and voting, which are two things that are enormously contentious and subject to demagoguery. As best I know, outside of a like rather small community of academics and professional advocates, nobody wanted this. Was anybody saying like, oh, I really want my neighbor from the World Bank to be able to vote for ANC that nobody already votes for? I mean, it is true. This is not unique to Washington. It happens in, you know, I'm sure in like Ann Arbor and Berkeley and a bunch of like very, you know, progressive sort of academic places. It's not like odious or anything, but the idea of like making this a priority that people would risk the city's home rule seems absolutely nuts. For a thing that, as best I can tell, has no major constituency among the general public, particularly among the voting public.
But I mean, there are advocates for this. I mean, you know, there's groups including Claudia Jones School of Political Education, the DC Latino Caucus, DC for Democracy. There's all these local immigrant rights groups that have called for expanding the voting rights, you know, in DC and to engage, you know, these underserved communities. So it's not that there's no voice for this.
But look, these are narrow activist organizations, right? This is not a groundswell. I mean, this is city politics, right? A lot of city politics anywhere is about like getting your garbage picked up. You know, there's a groundswell of people who wanted like the alleys repaved because the alleys were in like terrible shape. Mm-hmm. This ain't that.
Right. And this is like, once again, a timing issue. Like, what is President Biden doing when it comes to foreign policy and migrants? He's limiting the ability of migrants claiming asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border. The administration has considered restarting the family detention policy for migrants, right? So, like, this is coming at a time when people are like, we got to be hard on immigration, too. And so I think what Mark Seagrave said yesterday about getting the message across to council saying you need to take in mind now, I guess, what the president and what the rest of Congress is going to say regarding this, I wonder how much that's going to impact the upcoming bills that are going to come through DC Council. Like, does that mean every single consideration we have, we got to think, oh, we got to ballpark it more moderate because even though like maybe the people of DC want this very certain thing, like we got to make it a little more moderate to just get it through to Congress.
This is another one where I think the views of the DC Council are probably really out of step with most of the rest of the country, which is their right, but which is also going to prove like really problematic and dangerous because they start messing with stuff that really doesn't matter to you, that doesn't affect your life today, and it's abortion rights tomorrow. That's the slippery slope, and it's pretty scary to a lot of people. Hey, DC art lovers, award-winning actress and playwright Anna Deavere Smith is giving a four-part lecture series at the National Gallery of Art. It is called Chasing That Which Is Not Me / Chasing That Which Is Me. Smith is known for her roles in The West Wing, Inventing Anna and Nurse Jackie, so you definitely want to come take a listen. It'll be every Sunday from April 28th to May 19th at 2 p.m. And the best part is they are totally free! Register to secure your spot at nga.gov/melon24. Juliet, let's talk about something that Congress probably won't mess with, but maybe they should. I don't know. What do you think? Tell us about dress codes in bars.
So there was a big controversy over the last week or so for this bar called Bunker. It's a gay dance club. It has downstairs, all that stuff. They wanted to ban high heels and flip-flops from the bar. They said that they wanted to do this because, like, in order to get to the bar, you have to go down these, like, dimly lit concrete stairs. It's dark, all of these things. I don't know if any of you have tried to dance at a club in high heels, but like the chances of breaking an ankle, very high. They received a lot of pushback on this, particularly from trans women, people who are effeminate or femme presenting, saying that it limits their options and abilities to express themselves. Bunker obviously reversed course over the last day or so. They now have it as a suggestion. That you
a strong suggestion.
A very strong suggestion.
Wait, so was the motivation for this like legal cover your butt? You know,
probably.
Was this like, was like, oh, we don't want to get sued by someone who breaks their ankle on the dance floor?
I think it might be more like you fell down the stairs, not like you're going too hard.
That's probably true.
I'm sort of pausing on the idea that high heels are like, you know, essential to your right to your identity, as if it was like turbans with members of the Sikh community or something. Is that really the case?
I think for some people who are like femme presenting, that is part of what they want to be. They want to show that they are like effeminate in some way and high heels because society has conditioned us to believe that that is something that we associate with women, with people who present as feminine. Yeah, in some ways, I guess that's the case.
I think it's more of a matter like you're going out for the night, you're getting dressed up, you're putting your heels on. You don't know where you're going to be going for the night yet. Like, you might not know you're going to this specific bar. And then you show up looking super hot in your heels and you're turned away. I mean, that sucks. Like, that's like you're not going to be going to this club because of your heels. Unless you're going out knowing that you're going to go to this specific place and dressing accordingly, which I think is kind of a big ask.
Okay, but the thing with like bars and restaurants, right, is that they're trying to create this whole ambiance.
Absolutely.
This whole vibe and how your fellow diners and drinkers are dressed is part of that vibe. And so this is not like the first recent case of a place trying to limit what people wear when they get there, in, you know, in the name of branding or marketing or something.
Right. So I think people might remember that last year there was a Japanese restaurant called Shoto that got slammed for denying Chef Marjorie Meek Bradley entry to the restaurant because she was wearing Birks. She was going there to eat with friends, something like that. And one of the other chefs, like, came in orthopedic shoes and a ball cap, and, like, that was okay. But they drew the line at Birkenstocks. Like, that was, like, the last straw. El Centro, back in 2017, got in trouble for denying people in sneakers, but only selectively. There was a Black patron who was turned away for wearing just, like, basic shoes. And then when people went into the club, they snapped photos, and, like, a bunch of white people were wearing, like, Converse and sneakers and stuff like that. So, yes, like, I think part of this is an enforcement selectability thing, where, yeah, like, if you're going to enforce the dress code, like, full sail, like, if Bunker would have been like, you know what, no one in high heels allowed. Also, like, every dude in flip-flops and cargo shorts, like, you also, you cannot be here. Like, fine. But I find that one thing that happens with dress codes is the enforceability just, like, really goes amok. And it's very, very selective in yeah. terms of that.
Well, I think that's the problem. It's basically impossible to enforce a dress code without bias, right? Mm. Like, it depends on the bouncer. Like, it depends on the whoever's working there that night. Like, it's not, it's impossible to enforce with consistency, which makes it really ripe for these types of issues, which is why I think a lot of people have an issue with it.
Right. So I'm planning to go out in high heels this weekend. But Kayla, because you edit our awesome Hey DC newsletter, you probably have way better plans.
Yeah. Speaking of going out... Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot going on this weekend. You know, we have a full list in our newsletter today, as always, if you want to check it out. But some of the highlights, or some of the things that I will be going to, this evening, starting at 5, there's this art show happening called She, DC Art Show. It's at La Cosecha and Union Market. And there's going to be over 200 local artists there. All the tickets and the sales go towards basically these mini grants that will be granted to sort of the winners of this art competition. But it looks great. I mean, it's a great area. You can get food, you can hang out, you can look at the art, talk to the artists. It's going to be a lot of fun. The next thing, we have a couple things going on Saturday that I would recommend. You may have heard our episode about DC's death doula. Well, she's going to be doing an event this weekend on Saturday at the Congressional Cemetery. She's pairing up with this viral TikToker, Rosie Grant, who has basically, she's has this project where she goes around and she cooks the recipes found on people's gravestones.
Wait, that's so cool. Oh my God.
Which is wild, right? And she has this whole account.
Wait. I'm sorry. The recipes are found on people's gravestones, or the cooking is done on people's gravestones?
Yeah, people on their gravestones will, like, put their favorite cookie recipe, and then she'll go around and she'll bake them and try them and, like, see how good they are.
How many gravestones have recipes?
A lot, apparently. I mean, like, she's done dozens, at least. She gets pictures from around the country, but she's originally from D.C., actually.
I misunderstood. I thought you meant that these recipes were all on Congressional Cemetery gravestones, but you're saying
there are some, but not all of them. These are from around the country. Yeah, she'll be making a snickerdoodle recipe from a gravestone at the Congressional Cemetery for everybody to try.
To be clear, if you want
a gravestone cookie, now's your chance.
To be clear, if you had to put a recipe on your gravestone, guys, what would it be if you had to choose?
That's hard. That's really hard.
Some sort of hair of the dog recipe because, you know, who knows? Maybe it'll help.
Yeah, like a cocktail recipe.
Ooh, fair enough. Fair
like
enough.
Your favorite old fashioned.
Oh, my God.
I don't know. Not cookies. I feel like that's too normal.
I want to have my grave fitted with like a hot plate or like a cooktop.
A full bar at Michael Schaefer's grave. Just a full bar into it.
It's like the party I'll never leave.
Exactly.
Absolutely. There's also on Saturday... tomorrow morning, there's going to be this day-long urban gardening forum with like dozens of sessions on everything from how to start your seeds to sort of history lessons about, you know, like food disparities within D.C. It is at the Anacostia High School. I'm an urban gardener, and I'm really excited about it. So you should definitely check it out if that's your thing.
Can they teach me how to garden anything? I have a black thumb. I cannot. Like, plants die.
I think so. It looks like it. Okay. Yeah. I mean, they have, like, indoor, how to, you know, grow indoor plants, outdoor plants, tomato. Like, they have everything. You can stop. It's free. You can stop by for one session. You can go for the whole day.
Actually, Kayla, maybe at your grave, you should plant, like, garden plants that can then be cooked into the recipe that will be on your gravestone.
Oh, my God. That's next level. Yeah. That is crazy. Like, have, like, a tomato sauce recipe or something. Yes. And then, like, have the tomatoes. I love that. I love that.
Your soul will literally be in the Sunday gravy that people want to make. That's very meta. I will give it that.
All right. Well, that sounds like an awesome weekend, and I hope you guys both enjoy yours.
Thank you.
Thank you, man.
It's always awesome to talk to y'all. And lastly, here is today's DC life hack. The Washington Women in Jazz Festival is happening right now. Check our show notes for the full schedule and ticket info. But one event you don't need a ticket for is tonight's All-Stars performance at the Westminster Church. Just show up. It's $10 at the door. Enjoy. And that is all for today here on CityCast DC. Our lead producer is Priyanka Tilvey. Our producer is Julia Caron. Our newsletter writer is Kayla Cote Stemmerman. And our hosts are Bridget Todd and me, Michael Schaefer from Politico. Music is by Alex Roldan. If you enjoyed the show, chisel its URL into your gravestone, dc.citycast.fm. We'll be back Monday morning with more news from around the city. Bye.
One is, you might have heard our episode on DC's death doula. I'm so sorry. Okay, I'll try that again.
The death doula.